This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. What I Saw in America by G. K. Chesterton. Section 5, Chapter 3, Part 1. A Meditation in Broadway. When I had looked at the lights of Broadway by night, I made to my American friends an innocent remark that seemed for some reason to amuse them. I had looked, not without joy, at that long kaleidoscope of colored lights arranged in large letters and sprawling trademarks, advertising everything from pork to pianos, through the agency of the two most vivid and most mystical of the gifts of God, color and fire. I said to them in my simplicity, "What a glorious garden of wonders this would be to anyone who was lucky enough to be unable to read." Here it is but a text for a further suggestion. Let us suppose that there does walk down this flaming avenue a peasant of the sort called scornfully an illiterate peasant, by those who think that insisting on people reading and writing is the best way to keep out the spies who read in all languages and the forgers who write in all hands. On this principle, indeed, a peasant merely acquainted with things of little practical use to mankind, such as ploughing, cutting wood, or growing vegetables, would very probably be excluded. And it's not for us to criticize from the outside the philosophy of those who would keep out the farmer and let in the forger. But let us suppose, if only for the sake of argument, that the peasant is walking under the artificial suns and stars of this tremendous thoroughfare, that he has escaped to the land of liberty upon some general rumor and romance of the story of its liberation, but without being yet able to understand the arbitrary signs of its alphabet. The soul of such a man would surely soar higher than the skyscrapers, and embrace a brotherhood broader than Broadway. Realizing that he had arrived on an evening of exceptional festivity, worthy to be blazoned with all this burning heraldry, he would please himself by guessing what great proclamation or principle of the Republic hung in the sky like a constellation, or rippled across the street like a comet. He would be shrewd enough to guess that the three festoons fringed with fiery words of somewhat similar pattern stood for government of the people, for the people, by the people. For it must obviously be that, unless it were liberty, equality, fraternity. His shrewdness would perhaps be a little shaken if he knew that the triad stood for tang tonic today, tang tonic tomorrow, tang tonic all the time. He will soon identify a restless ribbon of red lettering, red-hot and rebellious, as the saying, "Give me liberty or give me death." He will fail to identify it as the equally famous saying, "Skyoline has gout beaten to a frazzle." Therefore, it was that I desired the peasant to walk down that grove of fiery trees under all that golden foliage and fruits, like monstrous jewels, as innocent as Adam before the fall. He would see sights almost as fine as the flaming sword or the purple and peacock plumage of the seraphim, so long as he did not go near the tree of knowledge. In other words, if once he went to school, it would all be up, and indeed I fear in any case he would soon discover his error. If he stood wildly waving his hat for liberty in the middle of the road, as Chunk Chutney picked itself out in ruby stars upon the skies, he would impede the excellent but extremely rigid traffic system of New York. If he fell on his knees before a sapphire splendor and began saying an Ave Maria under a mistaken association, he would be conducted kindly but firmly by an Irish policeman to a more authentic shrine. But though the foreign simplicity might not long survive in New York, it is quite a mistake to suppose that such a foreign simplicity cannot enter New York. He may be excluded for being illiterate, but he cannot be excluded for being ignorant, nor for being innocent. Least of all can he be excluded for being wiser in his innocence than the world in its knowledge. There is here, indeed, more than one distinction to be made. New York is a cosmopolitan city, but it is not a city of cosmopolitans. Most of the masses in New York have a nation, whether or no it be the nation to which New York belongs. Those who are Americanized are American, and very patriotically American. Those who are not thus nationalized are not in the least internationalized. They simply continue to be themselves. The Irish are Irish, the Jews are Jewish, and all sorts of other tribes carry on the traditions of remote European valleys almost untouched. In short, there is a sort of slender bridge between their old country and their new, which they either cross or do not cross, but which they seldom simply occupy. They are exiles, or they are citizens. There is no moment when they are cosmopolitans. But very often the exiles bring with them not only rooted traditions, but rooted truths. Indeed, it is to a great extent the thought of these strange souls in crude American garb that gives a meaning to the masquerade of New York. In the hotel where I stayed, the head waiter in one room was a Bohemian, and I am glad to say that he called himself a Bohemian. I have already protested sufficiently before American audiences against the pedantry of perpetually talking about Czechoslovakia. But I suggested to my American friends that the abandonment of the word Bohemian, in its historical sense, might well extend to its literary and figurative sense. We might be expected to say, "I'm afraid Henry has got into very Czechoslovakian habits lately," or "Don't bother to dress, it's quite a Czechoslovakian affair." Anyhow, my Bohemian would have nothing to do with such nonsense. He called himself a son of Bohemia, and spoke as such in his criticisms of America, which were both favorable and unfavorable. He was a squat man with a sturdy figure and a steady smile, and his eyes were like dark pools in the depths of a dark forest. But I do not think he had ever been deceived by the lights of Broadway. But I found something like my real innocent abroad, my real peasant among the sky signs, in another part of the same establishment. He was a much leaner man, equally dark, with a hook nose, hungry face, and fierce black mustaches. He also was a waiter, and was in the costume of a waiter, which is a smarter edition of the costume of a lecturer. As he was serving me with a clam chowder or some such thing, I fell into speech with him, and he told me he was Bulgar. I said something like, "I'm afraid I don't know as much as I ought to about Bulgaria. I suppose most of your people are agricultural, aren't they?" He did not stir an inch from his regular attitude, but he slightly lowered his low voice and said, "Yes, from the earth we come and to the earth we return. When people get away from that, they are lost." To hear such a thing said by a waiter was alone an epic in the life of an unfortunate writer of fantastic novels. To see him clear away the clam chowder like an automaton, and bring me more ice water like an automaton, or like anything else on earth except an American waiter, for piling up ice is the cold passion of their lives, and all this after having uttered something so dark and deep, so starkly incongruous and so startlingly true, was an indescribable thing, but very like the picture of the peasant admiring Broadway. So he passed with his artificial clothes and manners, lit up with all the ghastly artificial light of the hotel, and all the ghastly artificial life of the city, and his heart was like his own remote and rocky valley, where those unchanging words were carved as on a rock. I do not profess to discuss here at all adequately the question this raises about the Americanization of the Bulgar. It has many aspects of some which most Englishmen and even some Americans are rather unconscious. For one thing, a man with so rugged a loyalty to land could not be Americanized in New York, but it is not so certain that he could not be Americanized in America. We might almost say that a peasantry is hidden in the heart of America. So far as our impressions go, it is a secret. It is rather like an open secret, covering only some thousand square miles of open prairie. But for most of our countrymen it is something invisible, unimagined and unvisited. The simple truth that where all those acres are, there is agriculture, and where all that agriculture is, there is considerable tendency towards distributive or decently equalized property, as in a peasantry. On the other hand, there are those who say that the Bulgar will never be Americanized, that he only comes to be a waiter in America, that he may afford to return to be a peasant in Bulgaria. I cannot decide this issue, and indeed I did not introduce it to this end. I was led to it by a certain line of reflection that runs along the Great White Way, and I'll continue to follow it. The criticism, if we could put rightly, not only discovers more than New York, but more than the whole New World. An argument against it is quite as valid against the largest and richest cities of the Old World, against London or Liverpool or Frankfurt or Belfast. But it is in New York that we see the argument most clearly, because we see the thing thus towering into its own turrets and breaking into its own fireworks. I disagree with the aesthetic condemnation of modern city with its skyscrapers and sky signs. I mean that which laments the loss of beauty and its sacrifice to utility. It seems to me the very reverse of the truth. Years ago, when people used to say the Salvation Army doubtless had good intentions, but we must all deplore its methods, I pointed out that the very contrary is the case. Its method, the method of drums and democratic appeal, is that of the Franciscans, or any other march of the church militant. It was precisely its aims that were dubious, with their dissenting morality and despotic finance. It is somewhat the same with things like the sky signs in Broadway. The aesthete must not ask me to mingle my tears with his, because these things are merely useful and ugly. For I am not especially inclined to think them ugly, but I am strongly inclined to think them useless. As a matter of art for art's sake, they seem to me rather artistic. As a form of practical social work, they seem to me stark, stupid waste. If Mr. Bilge is rich enough to build a tower 400 feet high and give it a crown of golden crescents and crimson stars in order to draw attention to his manufacture of the Paradise toothpaste or the Seventh Heaven cigar, I do not feel the least disposition to thank him for any serious form of social service. I have never tried the Seventh Heaven cigar. Indeed, a premonition moves me towards the belief that I shall go down to the dust without trying it. I have every reason to doubt whether it does any particular good to those who smoke it, or any good to anybody except those who sell it. In short, Mr. Bilge's usefulness consists in being useful to Mr. Bilge, and all the rest is illusion and sentimentalism. But because I know that Bilge is only Bilge, shall I stoop to the profanity of saying that fire is only fire? Shall I blaspheme crimson stars any more than crimson sunsets, or deny that those moons are golden any more than this grass is green? If a child saw these colored lights, he would dance with as much delight as any other colored toys, and it is the duty of every poet, and even of every critic, to dance in respectful imitation of the child. Indeed, I am in a mood of so much sympathy with the fairy lights of this pantomime city that I should be almost sorry to see social sanity and a sense of proportion return to extinguish them. I fear the day is breaking, and the broad daylight of tradition and ancient truth is coming to end all this delightful nightmare of New York at night. Peasants and priests and all sorts of practical and sensible people are coming back into power, and their stern realism may wither all these beautiful, unsubstantial, useless things. They will not believe in the Seventh Heaven cigar, even when they see it shining as with stars in the seventh heaven. They will not be affected by the advertisements any more than the priests and peasants of the Middle Ages would have been affected by advertisements. Only a very soft-headed, sentimental, and rather servile generation of men could possibly be affected by advertisements at all. People who are a little more hard-headed, humorous, and intellectually independent see the rather simple joke, and are not impressed by this or any other form of self-praise. Almost any other man in almost any other age would have seen the joke. If you had said to a man in the Stone Age, "Ugh says Ugh makes the best stone hatchets," he would have perceived a lack of detachment and disinterestedness about the testimonial. If you had said to a medieval peasant, "Robert the Boyer proclaims with three blasts of a horn that he makes good bows," the peasant would have said, Well, of course he does, and thought about something more important. It is only among the people whose minds have been weakened by a sort of mesmerism that so transparent a trick as that of advertisement could ever have been tried at all. And if ever we have again, as for other reasons I cannot but hope that we shall, a more democratic distribution of property, and a more agricultural basis of national life, it would seem at first sight only too likely that all this beautiful superstition will perish, and the fairyland of Broadway, with all its varied rainbows, fade away. For such people the Seventh Heaven cigar, like the 19th-century city, will have ended in smoke, and even the smoke of it will have vanished. The end of section 5.